professional effort, made it clear that this was entirely a peaceful scientific expedition. Some of the women's magazines, which had been founded to agitate for suffrage, picked up Betty's story and joined her in rallying for women to be included in founding the colony. No men paid any attention to the women's magazines. I know, shocking. Masira sat down on the opposite side of our shared desk at the IAC. He's back. I glanced around to see if anyone had heard her. Not that it really mattered, but the other women in the computing department were all busy at their calculations. The scratching of pencils across paper and the shush of glass cursors brushing over Bakelite slide rules were punctuated by the rattle of our Frieden mechanical calculator. And even if anyone had been paying attention, there was nothing wrong with Basira reporting that Director Clemens had returned from the testing range. Besides, most of them knew what I was hoping to do. I nodded and closed my notebook. I set it to the side of my desk, pencil lined up neatly against it. Opening my desk drawer, I pulled out another notebook labeled Wasps, which had the figures I'd collated about the women Air Force service pilots of the Second World War. Standing, I hugged the notebook to my chest. Masira smiled at me. Operation Ladies First is go. I needed the laughter rather desperately. Helen glanced up from the desk she shared with Myrtle. She nudged Myrtle, who turned and gave me a thumbs up. Nodding to them, I headed out of the room and down the corridors to Director Clemens' office. There was no reason to be afraid of him. We'd enjoyed multiple conversations at holiday parties or company picnics. He was always a calming presence in the dark room on launch days. But before, Nathaniel or my work had always been there as a shield. My palms left damp imprints on the cover of my notebook. I stopped before I got to Clemens's office door, which was always open, to wipe my hands on my skirt. Today, I'd opted for a simple gray pencil skirt and a white blouse, which I hoped made me look more businesslike. Any type of armor would be welcomed. Swallowing, I went to the door, and Mrs. Kerr, his secretary, looked up with a smile.
Mrs. York, what can I do for you?
I was hoping I could make an appointment to speak with Director Clemens. This was me chickening out. I had the notebook and he was right there. He was reading with his feet up on the desk, one of his cigars clenched between his teeth. Smoke belched around him like a misfiring engine. The book he held had a rocket in front of a dusty red landscape on the cover, and looked more like a novel than a technical paper.
Let me check his schedule.
He lowered the book.
Send her on in.
Oh. I swallowed. Something about his crisp British diction always made me feel as if I'd come in unwashed from a field. Thank you, sir. He held up the book as I approached his desk.
Have you had the opportunity to read this yet?
No, sir.
It has a Captain York in it who sounds remarkably like your husband.
He gestured toward a chair.
Sit, sit. Have you ever met this Bradbury chap?
No, sir.
Well, I think you must be a fan. The notion of an ancient civilization on Mars is rubbish, but I will happily accept any press that excites people about space.
He set the book on his desk.
The American Congress is getting huffy about appropriations again. Is that what you're here for? Do you need another one of the IBMs for the computing department? They are offering.
I shook my head. That's really Mrs. Rogers' decision, but for myself... Well, they aren't very reliable.
So the engineers keep telling me. Overheating.
He grunted, nodding.
What brings you here?
Oh, well, it's actually about keeping people excited about Mars, sir. You see, I wanted to talk to you about considering women for future missions.
Women?
He sat forward and gave me his full focus.
No, no. If we want people to be excited, we need the most highly qualified pilots on these missions, or the public will have our heads.
I understand. But if we want to establish viable colonies, they'll need families, and that means convincing women that it's safe. I opened my notebook to the chart of statistics I had drawn up. Now, certainly you don't want to send the average woman into space any more than the average man would be a good candidate. But as an example, I thought that maybe you might consider some of the WASP pilots. There were 1,027 women who flew during the war for the United States alone, and they averaged 700 flight hours each, with 792 of them going well over 1,000 flight hours. The average fighter pilot, on the other hand...
No.
I beg your pardon?
I am not sending women into space. If a man dies, well, that's tragic, but people will accept that. A woman? No. The program would be shut down in its entirety.
I stood, putting the notebook on his table and spinning it so he could see. I think we could shift public perception, though. With these numbers...
No. We're speaking of women who ferried planes around as if they fought in combat.
Pressing my hands against the comforting grid lines, I took another breath. He had said combat as if that was a consideration for the space missions, but you wouldn't need that on a colony. I chickened out, the way I always do, and didn't call him on that slip. We're doing an air show. Maybe you could come out and see it? As an example of how we could shift perception of women pilots. The amount of training the WASPs had to go through was more rigorous than the men because of the variety of planes that we flew.
I appreciate your efforts, but I have to keep this project running. I do not have time for charity work.
He picked up the novel again and started to read.
Good afternoon, Mrs. York.
I closed the notebook and bit down hard on the inside of my lip. I couldn't tell you if I was trying to keep from yelling or crying. Probably both. The weeks marched on and my attention was pulled away from the idea of an air show, partially from despair, but mostly because the IAC was working non-stop toward a lunar landing. While the American branch was doing that, our European counterparts were preparing to establish an orbiting space station. Teletypes flew back and forth across the Atlantic as the rocket scientists shared notes. We were all pulling long hours. Still, Nathaniel and I tried to leave before sundown on Fridays so we could observe Sabbath. Not that either of us was especially observant, but it was good discipline. I leaned on the doorframe to his office as the heavy gray shadows of evening dulled the parking lot outside. Nathaniel had his shirt sleeves rolled up and was glaring at something on his desk. With one knuckle, I rapped on the inner office door. Ready to go?
Hmm?
He looked up and rubbed his eyes.
I've got a little more to do. Mind waiting?
You know, you'd think that we'd do a better job of leaving by sundown in the summer. Nathaniel spun in his chair to face the parking lot.
What time is it?
Almost 9. I came into his office and set my purse and coat down on one of the chairs. Did you take a break today?
Yeah, I had a lunch meeting with Clemens.
He turned back to the desk and picked up the paper he'd been studying.
Elma, if you were in orbit, would an R-bar or a V-bar rendezvous make more sense to you?
Okay, first of all, a lunch meeting does not count as taking a break. I leaned over the back of his chair so I could see the paper he was so fixed on. It was a report called Line of Sight Guidance Techniques for Manned Orbital Rendezvous, which seemed to consist of more questions than answers. Second, what's the assumed orbit? He flipped through the pages.
Hang on. Let's say 4,000 miles.
Putting my hands on the base of his neck, I dug my thumbs in while I considered the question. One of the challenges of orbital mechanics was that the faster you went, the higher you orbited, and thus the slower the orbit. It was completely counterintuitive without equations or a model. So my instinct as a pilot to do the V-bar rendezvous couldn't be trusted. The V-bar rendezvous got its V from velocity, which you used to catch up to the target by flying in the same direction that it was speeding. I dug my finger into the muscles that ran up the back of Nathaniel's neck. His head dropped forward until his chin rested on his chest. But an R-bar rendezvous might work. If we dropped into a lower orbit than our target, that would make the ship move faster than the target and we'd catch up with it. Once close enough, we could just fire thrusters to push back up toward the target, which should use less fuel. I had a possible answer, but given the little grunts of pleasure that my husband was making, I wasn't entirely sure he would hear me. His trapezius was a solid mass of knots down to between his shoulder blades. I'd lean toward an R-bar rendezvous. Less fuel, plus the orbital mechanics mean there would be natural braking action if the thrusters failed. Lifting his head, he leaned forward to stare at the page.
See, that's what I thought, but Parker wants V-bar.
My hands paused and then smoothed out his dress shirt. Well, he's been in space and I haven't. As a pilot, I'd probably give his opinion more weight than mine.
That's part of my problem. Everyone gives his opinion more weight because he's one of the original Art of the Seven.
He threw the paper back on the table.
Even on things that have nothing to do with piloting. I mean, he's still going on about the Soviet, excuse me, the communist threat.
The long winter hit them harder than us. The Soviet Union dissolved, for crying out loud. What's he thinking? Nathaniel rubbed his forehead.
The Soviet Union is gone, but Russia is as big as ever.
And starving. The long winter had affected the nations closer to the poles more than others. China isn't in any better condition.
I think he's trying to curry favor with Eisenhower by trying to, I don't know. And I'm totally talking out of school.
With the elections, people were starting to lose sight of the reason for getting into space. At least they weren't dismissing the importance of a space program. Yet. It's not always Nathaniel who keeps us late at the office. The next Monday, I got caught up in a series of equations for translunar trajectories. It was fascinating because I was trying to account for the shift in gravitational pull as the spacecraft transitioned from the Earth's sphere of influence to the moon's. It affected everything, including the amount of propellant required. By the time Nathaniel and I got back to our tiny apartment, I had a head full of porridge. Throwing the day's mail on the table, I dropped into the closest chair. My fingers were smudged with ink, but I still rested my head on my hands with a sigh. Space sounded so romantic. Nathaniel chuckled dryly behind me and bent down to kiss the back of my neck.
I thought I wasn't going to be able to pry you out of the office tonight.
Well, Sanchez needs the propellant calculations by tomorrow so he can adjust the payload parameters. I massaged my temples, trying to ease some of the strain from staring at numbers all day. Becky was working on it, but then someone told Director Clemens that she was pregnant and she was just barely showing. It's not like we do anything but sit at a desk.
And run back and forth to the labs, and sit in on tests where we're firing experimental engines, and propellant tests, and—
You are just as bad! I straightened and glared at him. He was leaning against the kitchenette's counter with his coat off and his tie half undone.
Oh, no. No. I would have let her keep working, but maybe kept her out of the test sites. But I understand why the director made the call he did.
Because, and I quote, pregnancy has a direct effect on women's brains? He snorted.
Politician, not a scientist. If something happened to a pregnant woman working at the IAC, it would set back public relations.
I opened my mouth to retort and snapped it shut. He was right, darn it. People were already trying to shift funding from the space program because they couldn't grasp the scale of the disaster that was coming. Turning back to the table, I picked up an envelope. I'm going to go through the mail.
You can pay the bills tomorrow.
I won't be any less tired. Part of our marriage agreement was that I handled the bills and balanced the checkbook. We were both good at math, conceptually, but I could do it in my head. Nathaniel needed to write things down, which meant I was faster. Behind me, a cabinet opened, followed by the rattle of crockery.
Baked potatoes and... we have a little bit of ground beef. Chili sound good?
Yes, yes, I have a husband who cooks. He does not have a wide array of dishes, but the ones he does know how to prepare work well with our ration books. The chili would be mostly beans, but tasty. That would be welcome. There was a letter from Herschel, which I put aside to answer over the weekend. If I tried now, he'd get nothing but a string of numbers and symbols. Electric bill, phone bill, those went in another stack to pay tonight. A heavy white envelope, which fairly screamed invitation, caught my eye. We got a lot of those from different people wanting to have THE Dr. York at their soiree. He was front and center at every press conference explaining trajectories and mission parameters in ways that anyone could understand. Doing the same thing at a dinner party was just tiring. But this invitation had Senator Wargan's return address. I knew his wife. Nicole Wargan had been a pilot with the WASPs during the war, and Senator Wargan was a vocal supporter of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. I was hoping that the combination of his progressive politics and his wife's interests would make him sympathetic to my own hobby horse. I opened the envelope, sliding out the heavy white card.
Senator and Mrs. Kenneth T. Wargan request the pleasure of Dr. and Mrs. York's company at a dinner party at 6:30 on the 7th of August.
Nathaniel, I turned in my chair. He had his shirt sleeves rolled up and was rubbing a potato with oil.
Hmm?
Senator Wargan and his wife have invited us to a dinner on the 7th. Shall I say yes? He shook his head, setting the potato on the counter.
That's only a week before the next launch. I'll be exhausted.
I stood and leaned against the counter next to him. That's your natural state.
Yours too.
He grabbed the other potato and rubbed oil over its surface. The muscles in his forearms rippled with the motion. Oil had splashed just above his left wrist and glistened with each movement. True. I set my finger in the streak of oil and drew it farther up the inside of his arm. This way someone else will cook dinner for us.
And I'll have to make witty conversation.
Oh, no. No one expects witty from you. He laughed and leaned down to kiss me.
Why this one?
I used to fly with Nicole Wargan. I slipped around to stand behind Nathaniel. Running my hands around his ribcage, I leaned into him. And I'm hoping that the senator might have thoughts about the need for women in the colony.
Aha.
He turned in my arms, still holding the potato. Keeping his oily hands away from my clothes, he kissed me on the cheek, then at the base of my jaw, then nibbled a trail down my neck. Between gasps, I managed to squeak out, "And you could use the same time to argue for the need to get off planet."
"Well, I'm still going to be exhausted."
"I could make it worth your while."
"These potatoes still need to go into the oven."
Laughing, I released my hold on his waist and stepped back. "Fine. Far be it from me to distract you." He bent down to open the oven door, giving me a look at his well-tailored trousers. "Have I mentioned recently how fortunate I am to be married to Nathaniel?" The warm air from the oven stirred a strand of his hair, and the light caught on that glinting oil again as he set both potatoes directly on the wire rack. He stood and kicked the oven door closed with his heel. The heat from the oven seemed to warm the entire apartment. Nathaniel lifted a hand still glossy with oil.
"I figure."
He traced a line down my throat.
"It'll take about an hour before those are ready."
"Is that so?" My breathing was fast and heated. "Do I have time to make my argument for going to the dinner party?" His finger continued its path, gliding along the collar of my shirt until he reached the top button.
"As long as I get to make an argument for staying in."
Counter-argument confirmed. 13.
Space record set by Le Bourgeois. Colonies in space would aid humanity. By Henry Tanner, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, Saturday, April 13th, 1956. Lieutenant Colonel Jean-Paul Le Bourgeois has given the International Aerospace Coalition another space record by staying in orbit more than 4 days. With this advancement, the IAC has demonstrated that working and sleeping in space is possible, a necessary step for the space program.
Nicole Wargan perched on the arm of the sofa in her living room, her glass filled with pre-meteor champagne. The diamonds around her throat glittered above a glorious peacock green dress. Around us, the living room was filled with the cream of society in tuxedos and rich jewel-toned evening gowns, enjoying the kind of food that a ration book wouldn't get you. If you couldn't hear what Nicole was saying, she might have been any society maven. Thank God she was more interesting than that.
So the mechanic had sworn that the Hellcat was flyworthy, but I was at 6,000 feet and my fuel gauge suddenly bottomed out.
"Over the ocean?"
Mrs. Heber clasped a hand over her bosom in dismay. Earlier, she had regaled us with stories of how she'd saved her prize roses from the meteor winter through heroic use of glass and steam. Too bad she wasn't interested in growing vegetables. I'd saved us by prompting Nicole to tell war stories. That I had another agenda was beside the point. At the moment, we weren't hearing about aphid invasions. I'd heard Nicole's story before, so I just sipped my cocktail and enjoyed the show as Nicole pointed a manicured nail at her.
"Yes, over the ocean. Well, I hadn't any other choice, had I, but to circle back to the aircraft carrier and tell them I was coming in." "
No, without an engine.
It was that or land in the ocean. When I landed, it turned out that the mechanic had missed a damaged fuel line. You should have heard the chief tear him up and down.
Unpowered landings were part of training, but landing on an aircraft carrier was a whole other ball of wax. She caught my eye and gave a wink.
Tell them about the Messerschmitts, Elma.
I had been perfectly content to sit among the other women and listen to Nicole tell stories, but when your hostess invites you to take the floor... Oh, well, we weren't supposed to be flying combat missions because it was too dangerous for women. Nicole snorted and shook her head.
Not that the Germans could tell who was flying a plane.
Exactly. So I was delivering a Mustang to the Ambérieu-en-Bugey airbase, and a trio of Messerschmitts comes up out of nowhere. The crowd around us had gained a few men, which I'd been hoping the topic would draw, but still, there were suddenly a lot of people listening to me. I took a sip of my champagne. Bear in mind that I was flying a fighter plane, but it didn't have any ammunition.
Oh, no.
That came from Senator Wargan, who had joined his wife. He was a stout man who carried the weight well, beneath a full head of hair that was just beginning to gray. Oh, yes. I had just enough time to radio for help, and then they started firing. All I could do was evade and hope to outmaneuver them. And, of course, the day was utterly cloudless. But there's this river valley that runs toward the base, and I thought that maybe I could find some cover there. Nicole leaned forward.
Which comes with its own set of problems, because you're flying low and there's no room for mistakes.
But it was better than being shot at. So I'm tearing down the valley with this damn, dratted German on my tail and another one flying cover for him. I tried to demonstrate where the other planes were in relation to me without spilling my drink. I have no idea where the third is. All I'm trying to do is use the river bends to make sure they can never get a straight shot at me and praying that our boys are going to find me in time.
And clearly they did.
Ah, the sound of smug masculinity. I turned in my chair. Actually, Colonel Parker, they didn't. Of course he'd been invited to the dinner. Senator Wargan was excited about the space program, so naturally he would want the first man in space there as another trophy guest, like Nathaniel. Nicole laughed at the look of shock on Parker's face.
She got one of them to shoot the other, flew the second into a cliff, and what happened to the third?
I never saw him again. I'm assuming that when our boys did arrive, they chased him off.
Wait.
Parker held up his hand.
You're telling me you downed two Messerschmitts without ammunition?
The nice thing about anger is that it overrides my anxiety about being the center of attention. I had the advantage of knowing the terrain. I'd been ferrying planes in for months and knew where the river forked. They clearly didn't.
I don't believe it. Are you calling my wife a liar?
Nathaniel does this thing with his voice when he's angry that always reminds me of my father. It gets very low and very controlled. Right now it was so tense you could have stabilized a rocket with it. He stood just behind me, only a few feet from Parker.
No, no, of course not, Dr. York. I just wondered if it was really a Messerschmitt.
He smiled charmingly and winked at Senator Wargan.
You know how excited ladies can get. One plane becomes three, a biplane becomes a Messerschmitt. Maybe the sun was in her eyes on this utterly cloudless day. I'm sure she's not lying, but maybe a little confused, that's all.
I set my glass down on the nearest table so I didn't crack the stem in my fist. Oh, Colonel Parker, you're so clever. Why, that must be just what happened. Laying my hand on my bosom, I turned to Nicole. Don't you think? She joined me, like the world's best wingman.
I'm sure you're right. And to think all these years we've been confused by the wreckage. Why, that prisoner must have lied about what kind of plane he was flying to make himself look good.
I declare... I think you're right. Turning back to Colonel Parker, I beamed up at him. Thank you ever so much for straightening that out for me. I feel like such a fool. Perhaps that was a tactical error. His face had red blotches at the cheeks, and it wasn't from embarrassment. He inclined his head.
Still, the danger you were placed in demonstrates why letting women near a combat zone was a mistake.
I'm curious, Colonel Parker. How would you have handled being unarmed? As a man. Tactical mistake or no, this got right to the heart of the astronaut issue. He held up his hands.
Look, you were clearly very fortunate. I'm just saying that you should never have been put in that position.
I agree. My plane should have been armed. As a woman, I'm smaller and lighter. That means that my plane needs less fuel, and I handle G-forces better than a man. That last was skirting the truth, because I was tall for a woman. And the ability to handle G-forces was more related to height and blood pressure. In fact, I would argue that women should already be in the astronaut corps for exactly those reasons. To say nothing of the fact that we're trying to establish a colony.
And men are better suited to do that work.
He glanced around the room and parroted what Clemens had said during the press conference.
Christopher Columbus didn't take any women on his voyage, did he?
That was about conquest. Sweat beaded under my brassiere. The pilgrims, on the other hand, did bring women. If you want to establish a colony, we need women in space.
I see no compelling reason for that.
Here's a reason.
Nicole laughed, lifting her glass over her head.
Babies!
Laughter bubbled around us, breaking the tension. Senator Wargan stepped forward and guided Parker away, chatting amiably about golf. Small kindnesses sometimes are the best ones. Nicole left her perch and came to join Nathaniel and me. Standing, I picked up my glass and saluted her with it. Sorry about that.
Please, I remember Grabby Parker from the war.
She took a sip of her champagne.
Have you met his wife?
I shook my head. We don't socialize.
You'll notice that she's not here tonight. Not that I'm saying anything by that. I'm just noting that Mrs. Parker was invited.
Speaking of invitations, I glanced at Nathaniel, who seemed content to stay with me rather than mingle. I'm putting together an air show featuring women pilots. I don't suppose...
Yes, if you're about to ask me to fly, yes.
She held up her hand, diamond bracelet glittering.
Wait, darn it. I need to check with Kenneth to be certain it's okay, politics and all. But I can usually talk him round. So if there's no conflict, then yes. Might be confused, my Aunt Fanny.
Swell. That would delight Betty's journalistic soul. Having a senator's wife on our roster would make pitching an article about the air show to her editor at the National Times that much easier. And, as an added bonus, it meant I wouldn't have to be front and center. Surprising amount of time in concrete bunkers. The smell of kerosene filled the air of the testing range, even in the control bunker. Having the test range 3 miles away from 203,400 gallons of kerosene still seemed uncomfortably close. I rolled a pencil between my fingers, waiting for the static firing test of the new Atlas rocket. This one was an easy assignment. All I had to do was calculate the amount of thrust and see if it would be enough to get a rocket into orbit. Any of the computers could have done it, but I was here because it was Leroy Pluckett's project. Damn good engineer. Couldn't keep his hands off the computers. But as his boss's wife, I had very few problems with him. Relatively few. He leaned over my chair, one hand sliding across my shoulders to rest on the chair back.
How's it going, Elma?
I sat forward so he wasn't touching me. Can't do much until it fires. Across the room, one of the other engineers lifted his head.
Dr. Pluckett, we're adding the liquid oxygen now.
Great.
He smiled down at me, and by me, I mean my bosom.
Just let me know if you need anything.
Absolutely. I tapped my pencil on the table, trying to draw his eyes away. I should probably finish getting ready.
Can I help with...
An explosion rocked the room. Sound and heat roared through the bunker, carrying the stench of burning carbons. It wasn't the first time we'd lost a rocket by any stretch, but that didn't make it any quieter. Engineers flinched, throwing their hands up to plug their ears. I twitched away and nearly fell out of my chair as the thunder died, leaving just the distant crackle of a fire. Sirens joined the cacophony. Pluckett reached for me as if he were trying to help, only his meaty hand somehow landed on my chest. Standing, I straightened my skirt and stepped back from him. My pulse shook through my hands as much from anger at Pluckett as from the explosion. You'd best attend to your rocket, or do you need me to calculate the size of the misfire? The weight of the bowling ball pressed against my palm as I stared down the lane. Letting out a breath, I advanced, swinging back, forward, and releasing the ball. It left my hand in a momentarily perfect line, then curved to the side to hit just off center. A split. Darn it. Again.
You can do it, Elma!
Behind me, Myrtle clapped her hands.
You can do it!
I spun back, skirt flaring around me while I waited for the pinboy to clear the ones I had knocked down. You'd think that a physicist would be better at this. With an arm around his wife, Eugene shook his head.
Theory and practice, two different things. It's like saying being a physicist should allow you to fly.
I can fly, thank you very much. My bowling ball thunked against the end of the return trough, and I stooped to pick it up, waving a little thank you to the pinboy who'd rolled it back. We had to remember to tip them well.
Speaking of flying,
Eugene said. Myrtle nudged his foot.
Let her bowl. I want to see the fireworks. We'll get you out in time to enjoy the fourth.
Eugene shook his head and pointed his beard toward the lane.
And I'll wait till after Elma's turn for my question.
I'll be fascinated to see where this segue takes us. The fourth was what had made me suggest bowling. After the meteor, I found fire raining from the sky considerably less appealing. I turned back to the lane where the pin boy had cleared the last of the pins and was safely perched on his high stool. He had a comic out, and even from here I could recognize Superman's distinctive red and blue costume. But back to bowling. To knock down both pins, I'd have to strike one at just the right angle to cause it to fly across and hit the other. I could see the trajectory. Give me a piece of paper and I could describe it for you with mathematical precision. I swung the ball back, its weight tugging on my arm like additional G-force, then brought the pendulum forward, aiming at the pin on the right. The ball released and for a brief instant arced weightless through the air before thudding against the smooth poplar floor. It rumbled down the lane and I stood there, arm outstretched, as if I could will it to hit the pins correctly. It brushed the pin on the right, which wobbled, and then tipped to land spinning on the floor. The other pin stayed perfectly upright. A commiserating groan rose from our little group. Laughing, I turned back and curtsied.
Next time.
Nathaniel patted me on the shoulder as he took his place on the lane. Myrtle laughed.
Next time. I keep waiting for them to throw us out this time.
My bowling isn't that bad. Eugene and Myrtle exchanged a look like I had just said something adorable, and then belatedly my brain caught up with my mouth. The us, Myrtle meant, wasn't our bowling party, but Eugene and her. Before the meteor, they wouldn't have been allowed in at all. This place would have been filled with white people, and I wouldn't have noticed. Now, with Kansas City being the capital, Myrtle and Eugene weren't the only brown people in here. They were still outnumbered, but at least no one was glaring at us. Embarrassed that I hadn't noticed the imbalance until she pointed it out, I marked my score down on the sheet and dropped onto the bench next to Eugene. He handed me my beer and raised an eyebrow.
So what's this I hear about an air show?
I don't know if it's going to happen. The beer was cold and had a bright acidity. The idea was to prove that women pilots have the ability to be astronauts.
But?
Nathaniel's bowling ball careened down the lane and slammed into the pins, throwing them clear in a beautiful strike. Yes! I lifted my beer to my husband's success. But we only have leisure craft. The more I think about it, the more I realize that no matter how good the show is, it won't look as flashy as a show with military planes.
That's a pity. Pilots would know it was a feat, but the general public looks at the trappings.
Eugene shook his head as he stood for his turn. He clapped Nathaniel on the back.
Good job, York.
Nathaniel picked up his beer and leaned against the back of the bench.
The air show?
Yeah. Myrtle peered over her glasses at him.
You make your wife follow through on that. It's a fine idea.
Nathaniel held up his hands and laughed.
You have a very different idea of our marriage than I do. I don't make Elma do anything.
The pins cracked and bounced, but Eugene had left one standing.
I don't know why she thinks any husband can make his wife do anything. Never worked with us.
You hush. Myrtle threw a wadded-up napkin at his back. Laughing, Eugene waited for the pin boy to clear the pins and roll his ball back to him.
So you need Mustangs.
Wouldn't that be nice? I sighed and took a deep sip of my beer. I hadn't flown a Mustang since the war, but they had been by far my favorite of the planes we had to ferry. Swift, agile, and a beautifully responsive machine. It might not be the highest tech these days, but it had been glorious back then. Eugene's next bowl knocked that pesky pin down. He let out a hoot and pumped his fist.
Now who's cooking with gas?
Myrtle rolled her eyes and stood.
He loses his train of thought so easily.
Giving her a peck on the cheek as they traded places, Eugene grinned.
Do not.
He leaned down to pick up his beer.
How does 6 Mustangs sound?
I stopped with my beer in midair. 6?
6 Mustangs. Where?
Eugene grinned.
My air club has 6 of them.
My jaw literally dropped.
Are you serious? I've called all the...
No. Wait. I pinched my nose. Someday, I swear to God, I will learn this. I called all the white air clubs.
Huh, take that!
Myrtle jumped in the air. All of her pins had scattered in a strike. She spun around.
And none of you saw that, did you?
I shrugged. 6 Mustangs. Myrtle exchanged a look with Nathaniel and shook her head slowly.
Pilots.
He sighed and raised his beer to her.
I don't know how you do it.
I let them have their laugh and just grinned at Eugene. 6 Mustangs. We could do proper formations with that and smoke tricks and... Are there any women pilots in your group?
Yeah. Come to the club and I'll introduce you.
He gave me a wink.
We can go for a spin and leave these two on the ground.
14.
IAC launches manned spaceport made of an inflatable fabric. By Bill Becker. Special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas. April 21st, 1956. The world's first space station is a huge spinning wheel of 4 sausage-shaped links.
The Kansas City Negro Aeronautics Club had a nicer facility than our women's club did. There was a little house next to the hangar, both of which had been painted blinding white with red shutters and lettering. As soon as we walked into the social room of the house, I became self-conscious and grateful for Eugene's presence as a shield. I was the only white person in the room. The brown faces ranged from magnolia tan to a deep blue black, with no one who was even as light as Myrtle. I stood out like a dirty handkerchief dropped on a clean table. Clutching my purse tighter, I planted myself in the door to keep from backing out. Everyone was staring at me. I tried to smile, and then I realized that the way I was hanging onto my purse, they probably thought I was worried someone was going to steal it. I let go, and that probably looked just as bad. Eugene turned back, smiling, and beckoned at me to follow him to a table with 3 black ladies sitting at it. Conversation started up again in the social room, but I kept hearing snatches of, "What's she doing here?" and "White," and "No business." Some of them, I think, weren't trying to keep their voices down. 2 of the women stood as we came up to the table. The 3rd stayed seated and stared at me with a neutral expression, with only a pinching of the nose to indicate disdain.
"This is Miss Ida Peaks."
Eugene gestured to the younger of the 2 standing women. She was short, with generous curves and ruddy brown cheeks. The other standing woman wore her hair in an elegant French twist, pinned with green Bakelite combs.
"Miss Imogene Braggs and..."
He gestured to the seated woman. Her orange dress with a narrow white collar gave her a warmth that her expression countered.
"Miss Sarah Coleman, some of the finest pilots you'll ever meet."
"Thank you for meeting with me." I took off my gloves and, at Miss Bragg's gesture, sat down. "I believe Major Lindholm has explained our aims to you?" Miss Coleman nodded.
"You want to be an astronaut?"
Well, yes. But my main goal is to get the IAC to consider women as pilots. The current group is entirely composed of men." I turned to smile at the 2 friendlier women. "I was hoping that you would consider flying with us." Miss Peaks tilted her head to consider me.
"So you can use our planes?"
Something about this conversation was off. I glanced at Eugene, but he had stepped back. That is a separate discussion, I think. "And if we turn you down about using the Mustangs, would you still want black women to fly with you?" Miss Bragg's tone was gentle, with mild curiosity, but the words held a challenge. "It depends upon the reasons for turning us down, I suppose." That answer caused Miss Coleman to sniff. "If it was because you doubted me as a pilot, then that doesn't seem like it would be a good collaboration, but otherwise, yes, I should still like you to fly with us. Major Lindholm has spoken very highly of your performance in the shows your air club has put on, and I need experienced pilots."
"Good. I'm game, then."
Miss Peaks grinned at me.
"Any chance to do some more formation flying is fine by me. You are okay with formation, right?"
"Absolutely. I was definitely planning that." It would take a liquid ton of rehearsal, but precision flying was mission critical if we were going to convince people that women pilots were as good as men. Miss Coleman shook her head.
There's no point in it.
Sarah.
No, don't hush me. You know good and well that even though we're qualified, even if this airshow scheme were to work, we wouldn't be allowed in the astronaut corps.
She glared up at Eugene.
Would we, Major?
He cleared his throat.
Well, now, they only took 7 men and had to take those from different countries and...
And none of those countries selected anything but a white man.
The makeup of the list bothers me as well. That's why we're trying to change things with the airshow. Once they see how qualified you are... Miss Coleman leaned across the table, face intense.
I was accepted into the WASPs during the Second War, until they realized I was black. And then they asked me to withdraw my application. What makes you think that the IAC is going to be any different?
Well, because we're talking about a colony and I remembered what had happened in the days after the meteor hit, when the people in the black neighborhoods were left for dead until Eugene and Myrtle had used their leaflets. And we'll make them. But to do that, we have to show them we can fly first.
Miss Peaks shrugged. I already said I'm in. Y'all can keep arguing, but nothing's going to change if we just sit here.
Slowly, Miss Braggs nodded.
If nothing else, it'll be fun.
Miss Coleman stood.
I've got better things to do with my time than help yet another white lady exploit us.
Exploit? I stood too. Now see here, I'm inviting you to fly, not to mop floors or serve dinner.
She smirked. See? That's the only way she can picture us. I'm a mathematician and a chemist, working in pharmacy, but all you could think of were servant roles for me, so no, thank you, ma'am. You can just go on and convince yourself that you're trying to save us. It'll be without me.
She strode off, leaving me gaping and with my skin too hot. I'd probably gone bright red with anger and embarrassment. I should have known better. I'd made the same mistake with Myrtle when we first moved in, and I assumed she was just a housewife. She'd been a computer for a black business that had manufactured hair straightening chemicals. I hadn't even known such things existed.
I'm a fool. Would you please convey my apologies? She's absolutely right.
I gathered up my purse and started to pull my gloves back on. Thank you for your time.
Did you say there was formation flying?
Miss Peake stared after Miss Coleman. I stopped with one glove half on. Yes. I didn't say, if we can get the planes, but I thought it.
And when's the first practice?
Does this mean you're still willing to fly with us? She turned her gaze back to me and a corner of her mouth curved up.
I already said yes.
Then she winked.
Besides, that went better than I thought it would.
I laughed, relief making it too loud. I can't see how. She cocked her head and her smile didn't change, but the meaning of it did.
You apologized.
Have you ever gotten exactly what you wanted and then realized that it had unintended consequences? That was me and the air show. In addition to Nicole Wargan, we also had commitments from Ann Spencer Lindbergh.
Yes, that Ann Lindbergh.
Sabiha Gökçen, a Turkish fighter pilot in the Second World War, and Princess Shakovskaya, who had fought in the First World War before having to flee Russia. I hoped the fact that she was an actual fighter pilot and a princess would draw some attention. Betty had been ecstatic because the princess was a publicity goldmine, and Nicole, bless her, had worked her political contacts and come up with a list of guests that staggered the mind, or at least my mind. Vice President Eglin's wife, Charlie Chaplin, Eleanor Roosevelt, which is how I came to be sitting in a borrowed Mustang on an airfield surrounded by bleachers and camera crews. More than one crew. All I have to say is, thank God for princesses, even aging ones who no longer had a country. It turns out that given a choice between interviewing a physicist housewife and a princess who flies with a tiara, they opted for the tiara. I was fine with that. I was even happier when it was my turn to fly. Nicole, Betty, and I were set to do some formation flying with Miss Peaks and Miss Braggs of the Kansas City Negro Aeronautics Club. They'd supplied us with the Mustangs, and as Eugene had promised, they were damn good pilots. And they'd convinced Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to attend. Have I mentioned that the crowd was immense? We queued for takeoff, following Miss Peaks with military discipline. The first part of the routine was simply a tight V formation, buzzing the airfield. I say simple, but during our second pass over the field, we rolled into a vertical bank of 180 degrees while keeping the V tight and even. After years of puddling around in my Cessna, flying at speed in a Mustang with a group of amazing pilots, a part of me came back to life. A part that might have withered and died even before the meteor struck. The seat pressed against my spine with the G-force of our turns, and the little blips of turbulence from the planes around me gave a tangible sense of the other pilots. These women made me feel vibrantly alive. The people in the stands below, they might as well have been asleep for all they mattered in that moment. We roared past them, banked to climb into a steep arc and then split apart. This next bit was Senator Wargan's idea. It was cheesy as all hell, and I couldn't wait. Six planes, seemingly flying out of formation and yet perfectly in sync. Over the radio, Miss Peake said,
"On my mark, ladies."
It was a formality when she said,
"Mark."
A moment later, though, because we were all already where we should be. I hit the button to release a stream of colored smoke in time with the others. We each dipped in an individual arc, passing the other planes in an intricate choreography designed to avoid the wake of turbulence from each other's slipstreams. Behind us, in red smoke against a silver sky, we wrote the word Mars. I finished the final upstroke of the M and glanced over my shoulder. The ground lay at my back, past the red mist. My angle was all wrong to read it, but from here it was enough to see that our individual strokes all connected. Damn, we were good. I turned forward again and hit a bird. Then three more smacked into me. Feathers and blood flashed past the plane with meaty thuds. I had to tilt my head to the side and scrunch down to see past the carnage on my windscreen, but by God, I managed to stay in alignment with my teammates. My position is probably why I didn't see my coolant levels drop, or the engine temperature rise, or the thick, dark smoke pouring out of the back of my plane to mix with the red. I thought I had escaped the bird strike unharmed until my propellers sputtered and failed. A bird must have been sucked into the radiator and cut a coolant line. Not that it mattered in that moment what had caused it. I had no engine. My plane was pointed straight up. No engine, no lift from the wings. The ground rolled overhead as the first turn of the incipient spin. There was a moment of zero-G as the plane stalled out, and everything seemed to float. Then the spin started in earnest. The urge to pull back on the stick was so strong, but that would have killed me. The plane flipped over again, showing sky, and then earth, and then nothing but the fairground spinning like a toy below me. Red and black smoke whipped past my windshield, blending with the blood of birds. G-forces pressed me against the right side of the plane and squeezed the breath out of my chest. Right side spin. I kept my hands lightly on the stick and pushed the throttle all the way forward. My vision started to go dark from the outside, from the G-forces, as I fought to stop the roll. Stick, hard left, full opposite the spin. The muscles in my arm burned, trying to fight the pull, and I just braced myself harder, pushing. God damn it. I knew how to get out of a spin. I just had to get control again. My altitude ticked away. The rudder fought me every inch, but I got it to the left. With that, the spin slowed, but I was still aimed at the ground in a dive. My canopy was smeared with blood and feathers. All I had were instruments. According to the instruments, I still had enough height to pull the canopy and bail out, but by God, I wasn't going to crash a barred plane while I still had space to maneuver. Dragging in a breath against the G-forces, I yanked back on the stick to pull the plane out of her dive. The tunnel vision got worse as I pulled at least three Gs, but it was that or ditch the plane. I was not going to do that. I tightened my legs and abdominal muscles, trying to force blood back to my brain as the G-force increased. Blacking out was not an option. I kept my eyes on the instrument panel, relying on it to tell me when I was finally, finally back to straight and level. My vision started to clear, and I took a full, deep breath before looking for the runway. I still had to land, but that was the easy part, even with obscured vision. The Mustang was a darn good glider, and I had enough height to bank and come around to the runway. I passed over it once to get a sense of range, and then pulled a 360 to make another approach so I could come in to land, and to try to kill some speed. My flaps were useless from the bird damage, so it was going to be a really fast approach. I peered right and left using the spots of clear windshield to gauge my position relative to the ground. It rose up to meet me and I slapped the wheels down, bouncing harder than I liked from the speed.
Breaking the plane, I brought her to a rolling halt at the end of the runway. I'd need someone to tow her to the side until we could look at the engine. Birds. God, I hated birds. Well, when flying, I hated them. Although, to be fair, the bloody birds had come out of this a lot worse than I did. A giggle came on me out of nowhere. Bloody birds. I was a terrible person. But I was alive. Sliding back the canopy, I hauled myself up as the remaining pilots flashed past overhead back in formation. They'd given me clearance to get under control, but should be heading into land now. I was clear of the runway, wasn't I? I turned to look over my shoulder. The runway was clogged with people. Cameramen and reporters and audience members and everyone was running toward my plane. Everyone. I waved from the cockpit so they'd see I was okay. I didn't need help. They didn't need to come running out here. Not all of them. The flight helmet was pinching around my throat. I could barely draw breath. Fumbling with the strap, I couldn't get my fingers to unbuckle the thing. My gloves, too bulky. Couldn't even get them off.
Mrs. York! Mrs. York, are you all right? What happened up there? Was that part of the show? Or did you lose control of the plane? Over here, Mrs. York! Over here!
Who was talking? There were so many people. If I hadn't still been in the cockpit, they would have crushed me in their midst. All of them crowded around the plane, and I couldn't tell where the voices were coming from. Just a mass of people shouting my name over and over again. A man climbed up onto the wing, talking into a microphone.
I'm standing on the wing of a Mustang flown by Mrs. Nathaniel York, who just survived a near-fatal mid-air accident. Mrs. York, can you tell us what happened?
On the other side of the plane, a man with a camera had set it on a tripod on the ground. Another man stood in front of him, gesturing back at me. They hadn't even let me get out of the cockpit. I ripped at my gloves, trying to yank them off my hands. Let me down, please.
Poor thing, she's shaking.
Around us, more people called my name. The man on the wing shoved the microphone at me.
Can you tell us how you feel?
I turned and scrambled over the opposite side of the cockpit, hopped down and slid off the wing. Like an idiot, I landed next to the television reporter.
Oh, and here she is now, Mrs. York. It must be quite a fright to have something like that happen. You're lucky to be alive.
Lucky? He thought I was frightened because of the tailspin. They all thought I was shaking because of it. I pressed my hand against the wing and tried to steady myself. I lived because of training that I received as one of the women Air Force service pilots during the war.
Of course, but it still must be frightening.
Not really. The birds in the air startled me, of course, but surprises like that are why we were put through such rigorous training as wasps. I gestured to the air where the other women in our group were still circling. If I could only turn the attention away from me as easily as they circled. Any of the other women in our group could have overcome that spin the same way I did. In fact, we have it easier than men in those circumstances because our bodies are not subject to the same degree of strain from the G-forces in a spin.
And how did it feel to be in that spiral of death?
Well, the death spiral is a different type of spin. I tried to do the society smile that Nicole used to such good effect. But when you're in the middle of a tailspin, if you've been trained, you only think about what to do next. I save the panicking for when I'm talking to reporters. That got a chuckle from the crowd. I kept my hand pressed against the warm wing of my plane. It had kept me alive even after those damn birds. One good thing about the Moon and Mars missions, those pilots won't have to worry about hitting birds. Another laugh. I do hope that people will enjoy the rest of the air show and think about what our lady pilots can do for the space missions. If we want colonies, we'll need women in space.
That's interesting that you say that. Can you tell me why?
Oh, dear. I'm not sure if I should explain where babies come from on television. Through the crowd, I saw Nathaniel. Or I didn't even really see him, because he was still fighting his way through. I felt him, his terror and the way he drove through the crowd to try to reach me. And now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go reassure my husband. The crowd laughed even louder. I didn't intend that last bit of double entendre when I said it, and I was fairly certain that no amount of reassurance would calm Nathaniel down any time soon. Wading into the crowd, I kept my head down, concentrating on the hard tarmac. Men's shoes, ladies in heels, gray cuffs, stockings with crooked back seams, and hands. Hands touching my shoulder or arm or back as people said my name.
Mrs. York.
And then finally,
Elma.
Nathaniel's arms went around me in a shield. I wanted to cower into them, but I used his strength to draw myself up. People were watching, and I could not disappear. People were watching. That thought did not help. I could barely breathe. But my husband was here. I lifted my head to seek his eyes as a guide wire. Their crystal blue was covered by a sheen of tears, and their edges were rimmed with red. His hand shook where it pressed against my back. I put a hand against his cheek. I'm fine. Love, I'm fine. It was just a tailspin.
30% of aviation fatalities are from tailspins.
He clutched me close and pressed his cheek against mine.
God damn it. Don't just a tailspin me.
I don't know where the laughter came from. Because I wasn't dead? Because panic and hysteria are two sides of the same coin? Because he loved me so much he just resorted to statistics to express it? Well, now you'll have to revise the numbers, won't you? Because I didn't die. He laughed at that and picked me off the ground. The crowd stepped back as he swung me in his arms. That's the image they showed in the National Times. First there's my plane, tumbling out of control, and beside it a photo of me, laughing in the arms of my husband with a crowd of people standing around us. Those are the only photos of me because as soon as we got off the airfield, I locked myself in the bathroom. Every time I thought I was together enough to go back out, I could hear the voices of reporters in the hall and got queasy all over again. So I waited until the air show was over and my stomach was empty, and Nathaniel's worry when he knocked on the door was too much to ignore. It would make more sense to be afraid of the crash, but I was afraid of the reporters, and I was ashamed to be so weak. 15.
Lady Pilots Thrill Air Show Throng by Elizabeth Rawls, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, May 27th, 1956. Hundreds of aviation enthusiasts turned out at the municipal airport here yesterday to watch the first international show of women pilots. Of particular interest to the throng was Princess Shakhovskaya, formerly of Russia, who flew loops in her vintage biplane.
The smells of garlic and ginger wafting around Helen's kitchen had my mouth watering. I was on cocktail duty and was mixing another batch of martinis for the lot of us. Women pilots perched on every available seat, leaned in doorways or, in Betty's case, sat on the counter. Betty held a newspaper clipping in one hand and the remnants of a martini in the other.
I quote, "The lady pilots acquitted themselves with admirable skill and thrilled the attending crowd. The pilots performed many astonishing feats, not least of which was the military precision of their formation flying, led by Miss Ida Peaks of Kansas City."
Ida sat at the table in the corner next to Imogene. Opposite them, Pearl, who had found a babysitter for her triplets, kept blinking around the group as if she were startled to be out of the house after dark. We'd even managed to get Sabiha Gökçen to join us before she headed back to Turkey, although the princess had declined our kind invitation with regrets.
"The most breathtaking moment of the air show came as Mrs. Nathaniel York."
"Why did they not use your name?"
Helen glared at the large pot of vegetables she was stirring as if it were the newspaper.
"It's standard convention."
I poured a measure of vermouth into the pitcher of gin. "And I like being married to Nathaniel."
"Just wait until Dennis asks you to marry him."
Betty waved the newspaper at him. "And you're Mrs. Dennis Chien."
"Wait, what?"
I turned from the martinis. "You have a beau?" Helen stared at me, holding the spoon in one hand and shaping the word with her mouth.
"B-E-A-U. It's French for boyfriend,"
supplied Pearl.
"And why don't we know about him?"
Helen rolled her eyes and looked back to the pot of vegetables.
"Just because he's Chinese doesn't mean we're dating."
I blinked.
"Wait, Dennis Chien from engineering? He's a lamb. We're not dating."
She spun and pointed the dripping spoon at Betty.
"You, read article."
"Aye, aye, ma'am."
Betty took a healthy sip of her martini and lifted the paper again.
"The most breathtaking moment of the air show came as Mrs. Nathaniel York hit a flock of wild geese and lost power to her engine."
I winced and glanced over to Imogene.
"I'm still so sorry about that."
"Yes, and I'm sure you control the flight pattern of geese."
She shook her head.
"And you paid for it, so hush."
Helen snorted.
"Good luck getting her to not feel guilty on something."
Raising my hand, I said, Jewish! It was also why I'd insisted that Nathaniel and I cover the damages, even though it wiped out our savings, because I didn't want anyone to think we were being cheap. And Southern. It's encoded in my DNA. Try being Catholic.